Up, we have a presentation from Kevin Youngblood, and we also not on our schedule, but I have had a request from the committee vice chair to invite David Longnecker to address us about WICHE. And we're going to start with that, and then we'll go to the bills. And so, David, would you come forward and tell us about
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Dave Longnecker. I'm the Executive Director of the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education, WICHE. I'm trusting most of you know about WICHE, and I'm here actually today for a couple of reasons. This is WICHE's 50th year, and so we're in sort of commemoration of that, we're going around and talking about the importance of WICHE to the West in various states, and today is my opportunity to come and share and celebrate a bit here in Oregon. I don't know if you're aware of it, but to some extent WICHE began here in Oregon. It was a compact of a number of states in 1952, then 13 states and 11 states and two territories. But it was really established, its first offices were at the University of Oregon. First executive director was a former senior administrator of the University of Oregon, and so he set up offices there. When he left his job, the next executive director took the offices to Boulder, Colorado, and we've been housed in Boulder, Colorado for the last 46 years. We're, as I mentioned, a 53-year-old organization, our 50-year-old organization this year. We serve a very simple mission. The mission of WICHE is to provide access to high-quality education for higher education for the citizens of the West. And we do that through interstate collaboration, trying to help states find ways in which they can work together and learn from each other. Very importantly, though, we do so not in order to make higher education better, but to make it possible for higher education to better serve the West. Higher education is simply a means to an end, but we know that it's a very important means to a strong social, to strong social, economic, and civic life in the West. And so it is our reason for being. You're ably represented on WICHE by three commissioners, Senator Deckert, Commissioner Bruce Borelli from the community college system, and Vice Chancellor Vines from the Oregon University system represent you before WICHE. They're all gubernatorial appointees. And you also served on the Legislative Advisory Committee by Ryan and by Representative Vic Beckland. We try to pursue our job through a set of different priorities. We do that by trying to expand access to higher education in the West to the citizens, by providing strong policy information and policy analysis to our member states, by promoting innovation. We are particularly active in the area of technology-mediated instruction, if you will, internet-based education, through our Western Cooperative for Educational Telecommunications, WCET, and through our Northwest Electronic Outreach Network, NEON, where we work with institutions in the West to provide high-quality instruction via the internet. And we do all of this by trying to foster collaboration through interstate efforts. We're probably best known for our student exchange programs, and Oregon has been an active participant in all three of our student exchange programs. The granddaddy, of course, is our professional student exchange program, and this is the one where you buy seats for Oregon students in other states. So you do that in three different fields. Currently, you're buying seats for 18 Oregonians in the fields of physical therapy, optometry, and occupational therapy. awfully important to you and to WICHE is that you also attract 144 students from other states in seven different fields. Those 144 students bring in $1.8 million in contract fees from those other states, and that makes Oregon the second largest participant in the professional student exchange program. Just to give you an idea how important this is to you, beyond just the delivery of services, more than 400 professionals practice in their profession in Oregon as alumni of our WICHE programs. About two-thirds of all the students who you support eventually come back to practice in the state. Our most popular program, however, has become our Western Undergraduate Exchange Program. Currently about 1,200 students from Oregon are participating in the Western Undergraduate Exchange. These are students who go from Oregon to an institution somewhere else in the West to participate in a program that they have that might better fit their educational needs. The benefit to the students is that they get an advantage tuition rate. They pay 150% of in-state tuition at whatever institution they attend. And the result of that is that they will appreciate this year about $5.7 million. I probably ought to calm myself down here a little bit. I used to work at the federal level, and I have a hard time sometimes remembering these numbers. But $5.7 million in benefit this year are appreciated by Oregonians. This is a truly reciprocal program for Oregon. You're receiving about 1,300 students this year, so you have just about as many students leaving as you have coming in this Western Undergraduate Exchange. It's sort of a model of interstate collaboration. We have a third program, the Western Regional Graduate Program, which is a much smaller program, as these statistics would indicate to you, with only about 46 students going from Oregon elsewhere and about 43 coming in. That's not a reflection of a lack of interest on the part of Oregon. It's that small. It's really a much more modest program with far fewer programs offered by institutions both in Oregon and elsewhere. Now, as you can imagine, the people who benefit from this program, as witnessed by these sort of testimonial statements, truly value the efforts that they receive. Ms. Malone Pruitt received her education at the University of Utah and has returned to practice physical therapy in the state. And Ms. Tona is a very interesting student, an adult who went back to school as an adult and has returned to practice in Lincoln on the coast. This is no longer just a program for traditional students. This is a program that's serving all kinds of students. WICHE has a lot more, though, than just our student exchange programs. Many people think of us as our student exchange programs, but we provide a bevy of other services as well. I've already mentioned the Western Cooperative for Educational Telecommunications, which works with states and institutions to help them manage distance learning, to help them find ways to finance it, and to find ways to assure quality product is provided. This has become an internationally renowned effort of WICHE. We also provide a lot of policy analysis and research activities. We provide a fact book every year that helps you in comparing how you rank with respect to other states in various ways. We also work individually and collectively with states. Currently, really marvelous strategic planning efforts of the Oregon University system and the community college system on a project called Changing Directions is financed in part by WICHE through a grant from the Lumina Foundation, and we've been trying to help them work through the issues that you face as a state. We also provide a bevy of programs and services in addition to our student exchange programs, including discounted rates for telecommunications, various activities. We have a long-standing mental health program, not because we have mental health problems at WICHE, but because mental health has a lot of issues in the West. You're currently represented by Ann Brand in this general area, who's from your Department of Health. For almost 50 years, we've been helping public mental health agencies in the West find ways to better serve their constituents. And we spawned a little organization called the Consortium for North American Higher Education, following on the heels of NAFTA, which helps faculty, administrators, students, and higher education policymakers in collaborate in Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. So where there is an emerging or developed need in the West, we try to help out where we can. Now, that's sort of what we do for you. What I'd really prefer to spend most of my effort here today, though, on is talking about the unique environment that Oregon faces in higher education and higher education policy. You face what I think can legitimately be called the perfect storm. And the reason for that is that is the confluence of three huge waves that you're facing. The first is a huge demand for higher education that's coming down the pike. The second is a substantial change in the nature of the students that you will be serving. And the third is the constrained finances that you face as a state. If we look at that first wave, rising demand, you can expect a substantial growth. About 24, we're projecting about 24% over this coming decade in demand for higher education, with most of that occurring over the next 5 years. And this will come on top of an increase in demand for the last 3 years of 4 to 6% annually. So you're seeing already substantial growth, and you will see more of it. And that's the first wave. Now, why is this happening? Well, there are two principal reasons. The first is simple demographics, and the second is your policy objectives actually call for increases in participation, which mean an increase in demand. Let's look first at that issue of simple demographics. The reason you're going to have more demand is in part because there are more Oregonians. And as there are more Oregonians, as you're seeing, you're experiencing a higher number of high school graduates. And that is something you've certainly witnessed over the last decade, as reflected here, and you'll continue to see that over the next decade. Not quite the level that you saw over the last decade, but you'll still have continuing growth in the number of high school graduates. And that doesn't count those adults who are coming back in increasing numbers to higher education, who bought our rhetoric that lifelong learning was important to them for vocational and avocational reasons, and are creating continued strains on the system at the same time that you're seeing a larger number of traditional aged young people coming along. So you have simple demographics as one factor. But you also have the goal of greater post-secondary participation. And this is particularly important for Oregon because your performance recently has not been very sterling in this particular area. Your high school grads, according to our data, are actually holding steady. You're actually above the national average and the Western average in high school graduation rates. At least this was the case. But it's down from a decade ago. You have a smaller share of your 18 to 24-year-old population with a high school degree today than you did in 1990, and the rate continues to decline. Adding to this, you have a smaller percentage of those students who do graduate from high school going on to college, an area you got a D on in the recent Measuring Up statewide report from the National Center on Public Policy and Higher Education. You're down from 46. Yes, sir.
I'm sorry to interrupt. But
absolutely.
What's the date of the gathering of this data?
This data is the Measuring Up report came out in 2002 and was based on 2000 data. Our data is based on 2001, 2002. Data, so it's
when
very current.
2002.
Would have been before this current enrollment period.
Are the projections in keeping with our current economic trends, I wonder?
Well, it's hard to know what the current economic trends will do, because what they do is, at least at the beginning of an economic downturn, you'll see an increase in enrollments in higher education overall, because people go back to school. But then after a period of generally 3 or 4 years, you'll see that drop off as a function of people either completing their education or simply losing faith in the system. Is that responsive,
well,
Senator Morrissey?
Kind of. I guess Oregon is the 13th fastest growing state in population. Now, you know, we are in the midst or even the beginning I think, of a major downturn. I mean, beginning, we're in the midst, but I'm wondering what the projection is for losing population in the state of Oregon. I mean, you know, we're in the state of flux.
Well, that's a good question. If you essentially have a reversal in the trends, then you would, in terms of the population overall of the state, then that would affect that. We're still, the actual projections on growth were ones that we picked up from your demographers, and so they are not based on a presumption of an exodus or an outmigration of people.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I wasn't picking up the essence
of
your...
That's kind of what I'm thinking of. You know, we a lot of the surveys and projections are made just before.
Yeah. Well, and that would certainly apply to the growth factors. You still have had a very substantial reduction in the share of your high school graduates going on to college. Here I'm showing a comparison today to 1996, but in fact, if I had gone back to 1992, which are, you would even see a more precipitous decline from that period of time, it's one of the most significant declines in participation rate in the country in participation in post-secondary. Now, I would say that there's another set of statistics, the National Center, I've mentioned it, this measuring up report, that shows slightly different. What it shows is a lower high school graduation rate and a slightly higher participation rate of your high school graduates who go on to college, but the net effect is exactly the same. Of this overall cohort of people, you've got a smaller share going on to college than you had 10 years ago, and you are not favorably compared to the rest of the West or the rest of the country, and you're going in the wrong direction. Those are not very promising statistics, at the very least. Now, you've got a second policy goal, at least as I picked them up from the Oregon University system, and that is greater success of those who do go on to post-secondary education. You know, the great sin of American higher education, I think, is that we do a very good job of encouraging people to go to college and a pretty poor job of getting them through college once they get into college. We have one of the lowest college completion rates in the developed world. And it's taking its toll. As other countries have sort of caught our spirit in participation in post-secondary education, we now see that six countries exceed the United States in the share of their population that are receiving a college degree. And we have another nine that we comfortably sit in as a group right now that will all surpass us in the next decade as current trends are proceeding, because we aren't increasing the share of our population that are getting a college degree, and they all are. And you can imagine the countries, but there are also some in there that you might not imagine that already pass us or that will very shortly. But essentially what that means is that we will no longer be the world leader in higher education. In fact, we won't even be a world leader in the share of our population with a post-secondary education in 10 years unless we change some of this. I suppose the consolation is that you're not alone in this. At least three states face much more significant demographic challenges than you have. California, Nevada, and Texas are going to face much more rapid growth in the demand for higher education than even you have. And most of the rest of the West is exactly where you are. So that if that makes you feel any better, that's nice. The second wave of the perfect storm you face is that you will be serving a population that is harder to serve than the populations you have served in the past. Generally, harder to serve populations take more resources to serve well. An increasing share of your population will come from communities of color, for example. The number of high school graduates, the share of the high school graduates in Oregon will double over the next decade from 15% of the total population to 30% of the population. And this will be driven by an increase in the number of, in the percentage of high school, of Hispanic students who are in high school, an almost tripling of the share of the population that will come from Hispanic. Now, this in and of itself is not a problem. I mean, in fact, we sort of cherish diversity in this country. We should enjoy appreciating a more diverse population, and I think we will. The dilemma comes is that higher education in the United States traditionally has not served students of color very well. And just to use statistics from Oregon, 8% of your population today is Hispanic. 7% of your high school graduates are Hispanic. 4% of your college freshmen are Hispanic, and 3% of your college graduates are Hispanic. We see that kind of attrition in the ultimate success of students of color throughout the country, and it's reflected here in Oregon. So we have a challenge ahead of us in making sure that we can serve students, particularly students we traditionally have not served very well, better in the future. Not unrelated to this, we find the same kind of statistics for students from low-income backgrounds. Nationally, students from low-income backgrounds are about half as likely to participate in post-secondary education as students from higher-income backgrounds. This 27.5%, now 23.1%, compares to an overall participation rate in higher education of over 56%. So you can see that they're less than half as likely to go on to post-secondary education as if they were from on average. And in fact, we even find that amongst the most able students from low-income backgrounds, they're five times less likely to go on, they're five times as likely not to go on as if they were from a high-income, high-ability family. So income is a huge determinant of whether students go on, and you have an even worse record here in Oregon with only 19.1% of low-income students from low-income families pursuing a post-secondary education. The good news is that a larger share of your students, be they from low or high income backgrounds or whatever, are achieving at higher levels if they do complete their high school. They're taking a more rigorous curriculum, more taking advanced placement, more taking the ACT and SAT, and they're scoring higher. So there is some good news to build on here in Oregon. Now, the third wave
I'm just aware that our committee just got this from the chancellor maybe a week ago. So maybe on those numbers we can just get through them, because I know we just received the third wave report.
The third wave is you don't have any money. Let's see if I can get through that very quickly here. There is one piece of that that I just won't even, you know, you don't have any money and it's getting worse. You know that there's no nothing in sight in the future. Did you see this one that shows the state? This is a piece that I think is worth in keeping in mind, because the problem that you're going to have to address in part will come through things, through efforts in your chair, in your committee, and in higher education. But some of the problems are beyond that. This is the results of a study that was done by the National Center for Management Systems in Higher Education, done by the State University of New York and Albany, looking at state revenue streams, and finding that virtually all of the states in the United States face a structural budget deficit over the next decade. The date for this is by 2008. This is showing that Oregon, by 2008, all else being equal, will face a substantial deficit of 1.5% per year in a structural budget deficit. This is below where you are today, and you already have one of the most constrained budget environments of any of the states in the country. And it's not. And this really suggests it's not going to get better. This presumes a turnaround in the economy. And it does not factor in fully the increasing cost of Medicaid. It presumes Medicaid will continue to increase in costs, but not at the level that it has been in recent years. So it could be more significant than this. All of which really suggests that you've got a problem beyond just fixing higher education. You've got a structural budget problem in your state that you're going to have to come to grips with. The real effect of this is that that access is at risk in your state. You've got one of the highest tuition rates in the country. Now, there's nothing wrong, from my perspective, with a higher tuition structure. One can make a very strong, rational argument for the economics of that. There's a very high return on this investment for the society and for the individual, and so they should share in that cost. The problem is that in your structure, you don't have a way of protecting the most needy students. You have an inadequate student financial aid system. You rank substantially behind most of the rest of the country and behind the WICHE average, and you're well behind the leaders in this area, two of which border on you on the South and the North. Washington and California have the two best financial aid systems in the West, and so by comparison, you look particularly weak in that area. As I think potential students look at you. And then one of your dilemmas is they really aren't integrated in any fashion. So that when tuitions go up, your financial aid goes down. In fact, that's the time you have to protect your financial aid and even protect and provide more because you're putting the most at-risk students even further at risk. Yeah. So that's one of the real dilemmas that you face.
Yeah. Okay. The slide
yeah.
that you...
Yeah.
This is so small I can't read it, but does this represent all of the states and Oregon is...
Yeah, you're actually in better shape than many states.
Where are
you? Life could be a lot worse.
Yellow or the...
You're the yellow state here.
Okay.
And that's U.S. average. You could be Nevada. It's over here next to Tennessee. Those are the two states that are in the worst shape. They're going to face almost a 10% structural budget deficit by the end of
it. Does it identify the states? Or I can't read the...
Yeah.
Yes, it does. Okay, well, it would be nice to have a chart, a large enough chart... At some point that we could look at that.
I'd be glad to provide that to you.
I see the... Okay, I see.
We couldn't get that.
Okay,
yeah,
thank
I'd
you.
Be glad to do that. This is a very telling and, I think, sobering chart. More sobering in some respects for other states. Nevada is a good example. Nevada actually has a, contrary to you, it has a pretty stable tax base because, or revenue base, I should say, because they tax one of the few non-discretionary items in our economy, that being gambling, and therefore haven't experienced the kinds of reductions many other states have had. But they've got the largest growing state in the union, or the most rapidly growing state, and they're expecting, I mentioned, a 24% increase for you in prospective growth and demand. Theirs is 100% over the next decade, and that's what's creating the structural deficit for them, is that they just have growth they can't afford, whereas for you, it's really that you don't have a revenue system that's contemporary to the 21st century. And that's, I think, really sort of the end of the story, if you will, is that you're facing these three cresting waves, increasing demand, and increasingly difficult to serve a clientele, and reduced resources. And you need to find a way in which you can sustain as best you can a viable set of systems. Part of that's going to come through planning. And I would tell you, I think the changing directions work of the Oregon University system and the community colleges is really right on target. It's one of the best planning efforts I've witnessed in the West as I go around. But it's going to take more than that. It's going to take some work in this body and with the governor, and not only in terms of your support for education, but in general, whether you have a revenue structure that will support the public services that you've been become accustomed to and have come to appreciate in Oregon. And that's sort of my presentation. I appreciate the chance to be with you today. It's a wonderful opportunity.
Thank you kindly. We appreciate that you were in our neighborhood and available to make the presentation today. We had not planned for you, but we've made time for you.
Well, I sure appreciate that.
Thank you very much for the presentation.
Thank you.
It's helpful.
Great. Thank you very much. Good to meet you all.
Thank you. With that, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 238. And Jan, would you explain what this little bill is about? And I will call up witnesses.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is a simple bill from the State Library. Right now, the State Library collects data on libraries around the state, but they don't collect that data on school libraries, and they would like to. And that's what Senate Bill 238 is all about.
All right. Well, we've got three people signed up. Jim
Shepke,
Kelly Kuntz, and Nan Heim. Thanks again, David.
Did we get that chart?
Yeah.
Yes,
Mr. Chair.
Nan, are you leading off for us?
I am. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon Library Association in support of Senate Bill 238. And with me today to explain this bill are Kelly Kuntz, who is an administrator with the Beaverton School District and also president of the Oregon Educational Media Association, and Jim Shepke, our state librarian. And I just wanted to preface their remarks, first of all, by thanking you, Mr. Chair, for your cooperation in scheduling this hearing today, which is our library day at the legislature. We have had many of our members here today meeting with their legislators, explaining their support for Senate Bill 238 and other legislation of interest to our members. And our members are libraries and trustees of all types of libraries, school as well as public and academic. And we're here to support Senate Bill 238, which is, as you said, a little bill, but one which we hope will help to highlight what's happening to our school libraries in Oregon and help us understand and explain better. Jim.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Shepke. I'm the state librarian director of the Oregon State Library. Senate Bill 238 was introduced by the governor at the request of the state library board. We worked on this bill last year, and we're pleased that the governor has introduced this. As you've heard, the need for this bill stems from the fact that today we really don't have good data on school libraries in the state of Oregon. We don't know how much is being spent on school libraries. We don't know the staffing of school libraries. And this is of great concern because the state library board is aware that that school libraries are tremendously important to the education of our children. We at least need to know what's happening with school libraries. The state library has been collecting data on public libraries actually since 1909. So we have a very long history of collecting and disseminating data on public libraries in the state. We've come up with a plan to be able to report data on school libraries in cooperation with the Oregon Department of Education. We had some meetings with the Department of Education last year, and it turns out that they're already collecting the data from the districts on expenditures and staffing, and that they are willing to give that data to the state library and have us do the analysis and the reporting of that data so we have a picture of what's happening with school libraries in our state. Let me emphasize that that this bill would not increase the burden on local school districts. We're not asking for them to collect or report to the Oregon Department of Education any more data than they're already doing. The idea is simply that the data that's already being collected would be put to some use, would be analyzed and reported by the state library. We have filed a fiscal impact statement that shows no fiscal impact for the state library. We do not believe there's a fiscal impact for the Department of Education or for local school districts. So we think this is something we can do within our current level of resources, and it's something that that we'd very much like to do. So we ask for your support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kelly Kuntz, and I'm the president of the Oregon Educational Media Association, who endorses Senate Bill 238, which would authorize the state library in cooperation with the Oregon Department of Education to analyze and report statistics of Oregon school libraries. Last month, in the School Administrator magazine, a national publication, there was an article entitled, A Source for Better Schools, School Libraries. The author, Kathy Patton, stated that recent that student test scores are 10 to 18% higher for students in schools with better developed library programs than in schools where they do not have library programs. Her statement was based on 8 statewide studies conducted since the year 2000. They studied over 3,300 schools, And those state studies included Alaska, Colorado, Pennsylvania, New Mexico, Texas, Massachusetts, Iowa, and even Oregon. And in Oregon, in 2001, 513 schools were studied, and the statistics were analyzed. They examined the testing results of the Oregon State Reading Test in students in grades 5, 8, and 10. And they concluded that student test scores positively correlated with how much professional and support staffing there are in school libraries, how much time the librarians spend teaching information literacy skills, how much time they spend planning units with teachers and providing in-service training to teachers, the number of hours that the library is available to students and staff, the existence of a relationship between the public libraries and the school libraries, and finally the number of computers that are available in the libraries and throughout the school that have access to the library catalog, to the internet, and to licensed databases. At the recent White House Conference on School Libraries, which was chaired and created by First Lady Laura Bush, Keith Curry Lance, the author of these studies, was invited to speak. And he stated that the size of the library in terms of staff and collection directly correlates to higher reading scores. Clearly, Senate Bill 238, which has no fiscal impact, is a very important step in providing that statistical data that we need regarding the quality of our school libraries. I would ask that you support Senate Bill 238. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions of the witness?
Yes. How many elementary schools have certified librarians?
Actually, we don't know exactly. We'd love to know.
Could you take it? Survey and find out how many are classified staff that are not trained librarians as opposed to how many are reading, you know, certified librarians, because I suspect there are very few that have certified librarians. And even in the middle school, that is lacking. So when you say quality, you know, all of the things that you said make up a good learning situation, I think are very important. I agree with, but I just wonder if they're still there.
And we do too, and that's why we hope to have the statistics in order to find out.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, that question is specifically to the point of this bill, and we can answer that question in the future if we are able to undertake this program.
Good.
Thank you very much. I have no further witnesses. Anyone else want to testify? No opposition to this bill.
I have one question.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Happy Library Day. So state law, just for clarity, state law now prohibits you from compiling just this ordinary data on what's going on in our libraries across the state?
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, the State Library Board felt it was important to get statutory authorization to specifically undertake this program. It's possible that they could have chosen just to begin to do this, but particularly in the fiscal climate that we find ourselves in, they thought it very important to come to this body and make sure that you are supportive of this, and that's why we introduced this bill.
Thank you very much. With that, we're going to close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 238.
I think that it's extremely important to have this information. And if this is the way that we're going to get it, I think we need to move this bill. I'm very supportive.
I'm looking for a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I will take that advice and move Senate Bill 238 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. I'm going to open up a carrier for this bill. I'm going to allow Senator Morissette.
I'd be very happy to
carry this bill. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 372. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 372 would... It outlines the procedures to be used for the Ione School, which is now in Morrow School, County School District, to create its own school district.
And we have sign-ups, and I don't see Senator Nelson. Here, Senator Nelson was going to come down and introduce this bill that he had sponsored, and I... we'll go stand at ease for a moment. You didn't get word. Okay. All right. We're going to stand at ease for a moment here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is David Nelson, a state senator from District 29, and I was one of the sponsors of the bill in question. Members of the community from my own community came to me and talked to me about trying to resolve an issue they had out there as the potential of shutting down their school. And I'm a great believer in keeping the schools open in these communities out in our part of the country. Usually a huge amount of distance to travel between them. When I say huge, I say 15 or 20 miles, potentially having young children on buses that particular amount of time, that particular amount of distance. And I just feel it was important for these communities to have the ability to come in and if they want to protect their school districts, to have that opportunity. So that's why I sponsored this bill. You're going to hear, I think, a great amount of testimony on it. So I will get out of their way, and they're more expertise, but my real purpose was to give them an opportunity because I have a strong affinity for these smaller schools that basically keep their communities alive, and I believe that they should be allowed to do that.
Questions? Thank you very much, Senator.
Yes, sir. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it very much. We have a number of folks who have traveled from Ione, Joe McEllicott, and looks like Marker, and Lisa Reitman. Are they here? Please, to come up. Please introduce yourselves for the record and let us
yes.
hear your testimony, please.
I'm Joe McEllicott. I'm from Ione. I'm 50 years old. I'm a rancher. I have four kids graduated from Ione school, two graduated college, two are still in college, and I still have a child, a junior in high school in Ione. I'd like to briefly overview the Ione community and economics. I'd like to read you a letter from Al Meunier, who is unable to be with us today. And then I'd like to briefly go through the procedure that the community has gone through to get to this point. The Ione community, if you'd refer to the map for the locations in eastern Oregon, Morrill County, it's been basically a farm community. In the past, historically, about 70% of the kids in high school have come from the country, and about 30% have come from the town. Due to the consolidation of the farms, CRP, and other factors, now it's been moved down to about 30% of the kids come from the country, about 70% come from the town. To do this, Ione has made the conscious decision that we did not want to lose our community, so we've developed housing in the town, and the school has been the magnet for the community. Just recently, we've sited a 3,500 head dairy there with 35 employees, the J.B. Beebe Dairy. And we are presently siting the Lifeline Renewable Energy Corporation, a wind farm that's going down in the Cecil area with 35 employees. The reason they selected this location as Morrow County is because of the schools. The reason people have moved to Ione to keep the enrollment up in the schools is because the parents were willing to sacrifice to move to the small community, less crime, with a quality education, and then they would drive the 40 to the 50 miles to work to Pendleton, Hermiston, Unitilla, Boardman, in that area. In summary, the school is the center of the community and economics. Okay, now I'd like to read you a letter from Al Meunier. It's addressed to the members of the committee. With respect for funding for the proposed Ione School District. I am a retired school administrator who served as superintendent of Hermiston School District, Pendleton School District, and Athena Weston School District. The parents from Ione contacted me seeking assistance with the development of a proposed budget for the 2004-05 school year. I contacted the former business manager of Pendleton School District, and the two of us constructed a proposed budget. The assumptions that we utilized were: the establishment of the Ione School District will be complete in a revenue-neutral manner, requiring no additional state dollars and avoiding financial impact to other schools within the Morrow County School District. The programs and course offerings in an Ione School District will be similar to Morrow County School District plans for the 2003-2004 school year. That the average daily membership weighted would remain consistent. That additional state funding was highly unlikely. We use the current level of $4,500 per weighted average daily membership. That if Ione becomes a district, they will receive a percentage of the cash carry forward from the Morrow County School District. That the existing contracts with Morrow County School District for certified and classified staff would be honored. Salary increases would not exceed 2% per year. Health benefits were capped in the current contract. We did allow 5% per year in negotiated increases. The transportation figure is based on the contractor's estimate. This figure is consistent with funds allotted to transportation in the Ione area by the Morrow County School District. The taxpayers of Ione will continue to pay their fair share of the Morrow County District's bonded indebtedness. Using the above assumptions, we calculated that revenue for the proposed district would be $1,483,000. The expense, $1,323,000, which allows for a contingency of $160,000. Once again, these budget numbers reflect revenue and expense requirements for the Ione School District and avoid impacts to the state and Morrow County School District. At the meeting in Ione on Tuesday evening, I stated that the decision should be made on the basis of having local control of the schools in Ione. It provides an opportunity to solve local problems locally. I'm convinced Ione can offer a quality program to the students of the community.
Thank you very much.
Now I'd like to just briefly lead you through the process of how we got to where we are now. The Morrow County School District Budget Committee was called to work session in mid-November of 2002, several months earlier than normal. At this meeting, Budget Committee members were informed of ongoing state funding shortages as well as some recently established goals of the Morrow County School District to have equity in spending. Each school was to spend only what their students generated. In Morrow County, this meant that schools in the more sparsely populated south end of the county were essentially operating over budget. When word of the impending budget cuts were known, the first of a series of community meetings was held in Ione. At this meeting, public was educated on school funding formula and the amount Ione needed to cut from its budget. From that meeting, we came a united message which was presented at the December meeting of the school board, Morrill County School Board. Ione was willing to take their fair share of the cuts, but consolidating with other school in the district was not an option to be considered. As a whole, the community felt an exceptional education could be offered, even with the cuts. Then we had a second community meeting. This community meeting met in the latter part of December. It was a brainstorm session. The community met with about 150 people present. The public was invited, and the press was there, and it was also reported in the Eastern Oregonian. Every idea was posted without comment. There were ideas for cuts, for prioritization in the school, and there was also ideas for continued stability within the Ione Community School. The cuts were passed on to the Morrill County School Superintendent. He sorted those out, cuts which were possible and not possible. At that time, I was also, and one of those suggestions was for the long-term stability of Ione was the creation of Ione School District. At that time in December, I was asked to talk to the school board members, and I visited with 5 of the 7 school board members and ran that idea past them and get their feelings. They did have some concerns, so we knew which concerns we had to address if we were going to pursue this. Third community meeting, about 150 showed up, including the press. At that time, we were there to prioritize the possible cuts. We did that. We did it in a couple different methods, and we arrived at the same conclusion each time. The priorities were summarized and forwarded to the superintendent. Some of the committees reported what they'd been doing, the advisory board, the site council, the lobbying committee, the Ione Education Committee, which is forming an Ione Education nonprofit foundation. The teachers and staff met. They're helping, working on scheduling. And the Self-Determination Committee, which we are here representing today. A large number of Ione residents are involved in this process. As I said before, there's about 150 present. The board met in the February meeting, the Morrill County School Board met. It failed to act on the consolidation issue. By their current policy, a move to consolidate would have had to happen in February to consolidate in September. However, the board did discuss the issue, and it was clear that consolidation was a desired option by several of the board members. We had our fourth community meeting last Tuesday. At that meeting, we presented all the information and facts regarding the formation of the Ione School District. Official petitions to the Boundary Board to redraw the district boundaries were presented, and close to 200 signatures were gathered that night. Under the rules, we are required to get 5% of the registered voters, which is approximately 231 out of the whole entire district. As of this date, we have 358 signatures, and 281 of those are from Ione, which exceeds two-thirds of the registered voters in Ione. The question has been raised, why legislation when the petition effort is proceeding so well? Short answer is expedite and clarify. A great deal of uncertainty exists concerning the Morrill County School Board. 5 at-large positions are up for election in May. The legislation goes hand in hand with the petition. The legislation clarifies the statute and allows the process to proceed more quickly. Legislation solves the timing problem and is less uncertain to the community. In summary, I'd like to stress that this process has been open to the public the entire process since the first part of December. The Ione School District has no negative economic impact on the state or the remaining Morrill County School District. Ione School District can continue to offer quality education. And if you'd refer to that map I gave you with Ione on it, if we don't get the Ione School District and we consolidate, you can take your eraser and erase Ione from the map. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Ann Mortar. I am the mother of two kids attending Ione School, and I serve on the Morrow County School District's countywide budget committee as well as numerous other school committees, one of the occupational hazards of being a stay-at-home mom. I'm to speak to the quality of the school. Ione School has always found ways to provide good educational experiences to their students. High expectations come from students, parents, and the community. A high percentage of Ione graduates go on to higher education. Last year, 100% of the graduating seniors earned their certificates of initial mastery, a testimony not only to the desire of the students, but also to the staff. The staff is qualified and committed to the kids and to the community. Ione is a three-time winner of the Oregonian Cup and has twice earned an excellent rating on its state report card. I have witnessed the school kids at Ione learn to see the bigger picture of life, not from a breathtaking array of electives, but from taking a trip to Burnside to feed the homeless, or by working for 2 years to participate in the International Club trip, or by representing their school at athletic events all over the state. These kids fill leadership roles at school, sometimes out of necessity, but whatever takes them there, they discover those skills transfer over to the bigger ponds they eventually land in. It's not hard to figure why our kids succeed. Those reasons are strong parental and community support. From the start of this process, the community of Ione has faced the problem with a determined, united front. It is apparent that the school is extremely important to the community. Everyone from parents to future parents to grandparents have attended the meetings and participated. Our effort to form the Ione School District has been done respectfully and with no intent to harm any other part of the district. We only wish to continue to serve the students and community we have historically served. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I have a senator in the back who would like to testify. Senator Brown, would you come forward? And we'll...
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. I represent a little bit of Northeast Portland, a lot of bit of Southeast Portland, and a little bit of Milwaukee. And I'm sure you're wondering why I'm here today to testify on this bill. Senator Deckard's going, what in the hell is she doing here? Well, I hadn't really planned to testify on this bill until I was driving down this morning, and I'm going tonight. As you know, Portland is also suffering a number of cuts in our school district, and two of the schools that are cited for closure happen to be in inner southeast Portland, my district. One of them is Edwards Elementary, and the other one is Brooklyn Elementary. Both of these schools are going to be closed. The kids are going to go to Buckman and Grout. I think one of the populations of those elementary schools combined will be 650 children. We're doing this to save money. It seems extremely illogical to me that we would close these small neighborhood schools that are truly the heart and soul of our neighborhoods in order to save money. And so that's why I'm here today on this particular bill. My children grew up in Enterprise, Wallowa County, my stepchildren. And Jessie, when she finished seventh grade at Enterprise School, she had 15, 17 kids in her classroom. I mean, that's a kind of quality of education that we cannot afford to give our children in Portland. There's things that happen in those classrooms that don't happen in a lot of other places. And I know we can save money by consolidating the Enterprise School District and the Joseph School District 10 miles down the road. But those are truly two separate communities, and those schools there are the lifeblood of those communities. And I think we serve our children a grave injustice by consolidating these school districts, by consolidating these communities, and really doing disservice to Ione if we did that. So that's the only reason I'm here today. I'm just extremely concerned about our schools. They are truly, whether you live in Ione or whether you live in Southeast Portland, they're the lifeblood. And I'm really concerned about what's happening across the state. So,
Senator Morstead.
Thank you.
Question?
I have
a comment.
Thank you. No question. you start the third paragraph by saying, in theory, Ozzy Rose is right that we should be consolidating. We have consolidated school districts.
Mm-hmm.
So if we support this bill, we are setting a new trend. And are you prepared to support the next?
I'm saying, Senator Morstead, I'm willing to pay for this trend. I'm willing to raise taxes. I'm willing to do whatever it takes to preserve the heart and souls of our neighborhoods and the heart and souls of our small towns and our small cities. So.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
They're like, get her out of here before she comes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you. All right.
Yes. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Lisa Reitman. I'm a mother of two children who are actually 10 months old and 4 years old, so they're not in the Ione schools yet. I'm here to testify in regards to the fiscal impact to both the state and the Morrow County School District from Senate Bill 372. I'm a 1985 graduate of Albertson College of Business in Caldwell, Idaho. I worked for CPA firms in both Idaho and Washington, and then became the Morrow County accountant. From there, I became the controller for Tagaris Farms, Inc. in Boardman, Oregon, and I'm currently the chief financial officer for Ritz Ag, Inc. and Holtz, Inc., as well as a partner in Ritz Ag Enterprises. So I have a combined 17 years of public, corporate, and governmental accounting behind me here. The things that I looked at in regards to the state had to do with whether or not there was an impact from ADMW changes or whether or not there was an impact from transportation cost changes. I'm going to summarize this really briefly because I'm getting the signal from back there that we need to take a little less of your time. I went into a lot of detail in this, as well as Mr. Meunier and Mr. Carty did on the budget that they did and in looking at these numbers with me as well. My conclusion was that there is nearly zero impact to the state fiscally from allowing Ione to form their own school district. I did the same thing in regards to the remaining portion of Morrow County School District. I looked at their operational budget. In doing that, I tried to determine what fixed costs would not be allocated over the Ione schools as they are right now. As Joe already testified, they have already site-specifically allocated all the costs that can be site-specifically allocated. The only ones that remain are administrator salaries, his staff, and some of the fixed costs that have to do with the district office. The number I came up with as a total for those was $281,000 approximately. Ione schools contain 8.9% of the ADMW of Morrow County School District. If you allocate that $281,000 to those 8.9% ADMW, it comes out to 0.14% of the Morrow County School District budget that we would be not allowing them to allocate back over the Ione schools. My conclusion is that is not a significant number in the overall picture. The other question that came up was in regards to bonded indebtedness and property tax base. I looked at that in regards to numbers given to us from the Morrow County Assessor's Office. The question was whether or not we would have an impact on the Morrow County School District's long-term ability to fund bonded indebtedness and capital projects, as well as if there were a change in the state funding formula, whether we would have an impact in their ability to raise property tax funds. My conclusion there was that the Ione School District would take with it 7.3% of the assessed value of the Morrow County School District. We have 6.99% of the actual student enrollment of the Morrow County School District, and we have 8.9% of the ADMW. That's a pretty proportionate amount. I don't think that we're going to damage them by taking our proportionate share of the tax base from the Morrow County School District. Overall, I did not find that there would be any significant fiscal impact to the state of Oregon or to the remaining portion of Morrow County School District from the removal of the Ione territory and formation of a new Ione school district as outlined in Senate Bill 372. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Well, I'm sorry, clarification, were you once a consolidated school district at one time? Do you have K-12 in your district already?
We have K-12 in various communities in our district.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's a consolidated Morrow County school district at the time. We're trying to break the K-12 system in Ione back out into its own school district.
Okay. My question is, you do have a K-12 system in Ione?
Yes, we do.
Okay, that was my question.
Could I answer, comment, I should say, you addressed that, your question to the last witness here about starting a trend. You know, you're afraid we might be starting a trend here and what we're going to do about it. I'm hoping that you would judge each instance on its own merit and realize that Ione's a unique town of its own, you know, has its own personality, and not kind of throw us in a group with everybody else, because we got a real unique community there. It's really actively involved to make it work.
Could I ask, how large is Ione? How many do you?
Approximately 350, a population of the town.
I guess I need to. May I?
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I have said several times before in this committee and other committees that what company in their right mind would move to a community that didn't have a good education system, a good health care system. So I believe that very strongly. And I guess what I was addressing is the question of reversing the trend of consolidation, which is a philosophical policy question that has been raised, as opposed to doing, you know, allowing local control and allowing a community to maintain the glue of their community, which is the school. So, you know, these are the opposing interests in this bill. And I don't think anyone is questioning the quality education aspect of it, because you have proven that over and over. And I guess the opponents of this bill are more concerned with the policy question of reversal of consolidation, is what I'm hearing.
Can I comment on that, Senator Morissette? I think that you're stating a policy. In my opinion, there's often a reason for an exception to a policy. In this case, we've gone to a lot of trouble to ensure that there is not a fiscal impact to the state or a fiscal impact to the remaining Morrow County School District. And I know that the trend towards consolidation is a financial trend. I mean, it's based on the concept that you save money by consolidating school districts. However, I don't believe that that is the case in this instance. I don't believe that it saves money to have Ione within the Morrow County School District. I believe that we still can provide the quality of education that we've shown we can provide in the past.
May I just say one more thing?
One more thing.
Okay. I am the only one on this committee who did not sign on to this bill, and probably because nobody asked me to.
Would you sign on to that bill, please?
Thank you.
Thank
we
you
have...
So much.
John Osborne, we are constrained by time a bit. John,
I'll speak very quickly. Mr. Chairman,
introduce yourself and tell us what this is about.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Osborne. I'm a Portland attorney, a municipal bond lawyer, and I have a prepared copy of my text, which I'll give to the clerk. Basically, my reason for being here is that I have been asked to provide a technical legal support to the people from Ione who want to create their own school district. Two questions that have arisen are, first, whether or not the creation of a new district would mean that the voters in Ione would no longer be liable or required to pay for the bonded debt of Morrow County. And the statutes and education aren't very clear on that. The United States Constitution and the Oregon Constitution are quite clear that changes in the law cannot impair the obligation of contracts. And so the procedure would be that once the district, the new district was created, Morrow County School District has pledged to the bondholders that it will continue to levy taxes on all the taxable property that was in the district when the bonds were issued. And that contract cannot be impaired by an annexation to another district or the creation of a new district. The old district would still have authority to levy taxes on that property. The new district would not have authority to levy taxes to collect the Morrow County bonds. And yes, there can be shuffling back and forth of liabilities, but bonded debt is pretty clear. This creation of this new district would not impair the rights of the bondholders or Morrow County's ability to pay for its bonds. The second issue is whether or not the creation of this new district is something that the legislature ought to address. Why is there a bill here? The reason that there's a bill here is because there have been prior bills creating separate districts in, I believe it was Columbia County. There was a change of boundaries between Sherwood and Tiger Tualatin School District. And yes, there has been, and I've witnessed it over 40 years of law practice, an effort by the legislature to consolidate school districts so that we don't have, we started out with over 400 school districts, and we're now down to a couple of hundred. So we're doing pretty well. The problem is that while that's philosophically a good idea, people don't live their lives based upon what I think is philosophically a good idea. And there are circumstances that the people in Ione found, which was the people in the Morrow County School District felt that Ione School was a loser, that it was costing them more money to run the school than it was worth, and that's the reason they wanted to close down first the high school part and then maybe some other. So these people have really done their homework, and they've determined that they can operate a school district as a self-sustaining unit, and that's what they're asking.
Any questions? Thank you very much. I appreciate that. We've have a couple of witnesses that would like to testify in opposition to this bill. The Chuck Bennett from the Confederation of All Oregon School Administrators, and John Marshall. Is John still in the room?
He's gone.
He's gone.
Yeah.
I have extended beyond what I thought we were going to have time for today. Mr. Bennett, would you make it brief?
Yes,
we're not going to move this bill today.
Thank you, sir.
We're going to, in fact, suggest that they solve this issue locally. If they can't do it within a reasonable period, then I would expect this bill to be back up here sometime in the end of March or early April. That is my considered opinion at this point. Proceed with your testimony, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to, I would prefer not to have my comments seen as in opposition to this. I tried to scratch out the, I checked the wrong box on that thing, and I think after listening to the comments from the folks from my own, really informed, well presented, we are certainly not the folks trying to stop the maintenance of local schools, keeping local schools open in either Senator Brown's neighborhood or anyone else's neighborhood. There are just some basic process questions that you are answering, Mr. Chairman, I think, with your decision on how to proceed. We are very concerned about the unilateral nature of the bill. We felt that this has not been yet fully fleshed out in the appropriate environment, which we think is that boundary board in front of the ESD. Certainly, if it can't be resolved there, there is an appeal to you all. For all of the discussion of whether or not we're headed toward or away from consolidation, Mr. Chairman, this kind of bill does head us down a certain road. I have a whole list of concerns that have been outlined relative to this. Just to give you a couple of them, we continue to be concerned about making sure that there is information regarding the division of assets, liabilities, or existing debt. That there is certainty about the number of students that will be available to the new district. We know that currently there are 20 students from Lexington attending the school in Ione. We don't know if Morrow County District would agree to give those 20 students up to Ione to keep in their district for their budgeting. We don't know how the budgeting accounts for those kinds of ADMW. There's currently discussion to change the formula relative to special education funding. Just taking a look at the special education funding for the Morrow County District, there could be some impact there. There's certainly, Senator Ferrioli brought up ESL funding. There certainly are indications that that funding to that district would need to be reviewed relative to that. There is, at the north end of the county, a lot of interest in the Riverside High School in Boardman. And the folks in Irrigan to take a look at their situation as to whether they should have a separate district, separate high school. There's a lot of this that can be brought into this mix. So, Mr. Chairman, we're very pleased to hear you're going to give Morrow County School Board, its constituents in Ione, as well as the ESD, an opportunity to take a look at this and bring you a considered report on exactly what would be going on here, and to make sure that we're not looking at creation of another small school district, or in fact two unstable small school districts who will require additional state support. We really appreciate the approach you're taking, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. And with that, we're going to conclude our hearing on Senate Bill 372. And we're going to finally invite up the gentleman that was invited to come provide some testimony to us. Kevin Youngblood is the gentleman I met at Legislative Leaders Conference in Denver, Colorado some months ago. He introduced me to a program that I found very fascinating, and we have invited him here to share with us what he has done or what he's working with as far as Pathway Public Schools. Mr. Youngblood, for the record, give us your name. And
name is Kevin Youngblood, Dallas, Texas, Flower Mound, Texas, and with Pathway Publishers. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it is an honor to be here and at your request. And just basically to share a few things in the brief period of time that we have concerning some of the things that we're seeing done in charter schools across the country. I am a little concerned. The fact usually when I speak before a body in Texas, usually there's a Spanish interpreter. I'm concerned that you don't have anyone here to translate from Texan into English. And
We'll struggle through that.
Okay. Well, good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You hold in your hand my personal bio, just giving you a little brief information about who I am and my background. I want to speak to the issue, if I may, of charter schools and some of the things that we are seeing nationwide, and I'd like to bring that to bear here. Charter schools started in 1992 in Minnesota, and they have expanded to where there are 2,700 nationwide. Most are realizing a great measure of success because of the low student-teacher ratio or the different educational settings that they bring to the table. Others are not as successful, and the system is weeding those out just as it should in a free enterprise school choice environment. Specifically in the state of Texas, we started in 1995 with Senate Bill 1, and it opened up a lot of different avenues for school choice, and one of them being the issue of charter schools and basically the ability to go and to appeal to, in Texas, you appeal to the State Board of Education to receive a charter. And now currently in the state of Texas, there are 215 charter schools. We expect that to be raised. We anticipate in the next 4 years for it to go upwards to close to 400 in the state of Texas. My observations of being involved with charters are, number one, most charters are with a lower student-teacher ratio than is in a traditional setting. And as a result, they're able to, I believe, get a better educational experience. One of the things that I've noticed, however, and regrettably, is that many charters, charter schools were initiated to bring to the table innovative and creative ways of educating children that may have been falling through the crack or may not have been as successful in the traditional environment as they would like to have been. Regrettably, many charter schools are just doing the same system, the same setup, maybe on a smaller scale, but they're really not doing as innovative as I would like to see them develop and to become. My experience in charters specifically relates to the development of a charter school with 23 campuses in the state of Texas that focused on 3,000 students, and basically in our charter proposal, it was we were proposing that students that were falling through the crack, students that were identified under Texas statute as being at risk of dropping out of school, our theory was to take those students, and these were students for which we were losing, in Texas we call it ADA, average daily attendance, I think here you call it, is it ADMW, I think. And these students were dropping out of school and were not becoming the productive members of society that we needed them to be. We needed them to develop into productive members of culture. And so our mission was to recover these students. It was to create an educational system whereby we could reach them. Through working with these students that were defined as at risk, we came to notice that they were all over the map academically. They were not at risk. They were at risk for various reasons, some of which were family problems, some were cultural background, some were drugs and other things that prohibited these students from really maximizing their learning experience. And one of the things we noticed early on is that a young man would walk in the door and the state of Texas would say, you got to teach him algebra. Well, why? Because he's 14 years old. It didn't matter that the child didn't understand his multiplication tables. It didn't matter that the child didn't understand fractions. And so we had to teach this child algebra, and it compounded failure upon failure. And so what we noticed is that we had to stop and say, all right, what does this child know and what do they not know? And so we crafted a diagnosis program where we were able to go back and diagnose the specific skill areas where they were weak, go back and fill those gaps in and get them onto credit recovery and onto feeling a measure of success in their educational experience. The second thing we noticed, Mr. Chairman, is that they needed an engaging curriculum. These students were used to the traditional setting, and many of them were ADD, ADHD, specifically the numbers on these campuses. The national average for special ed hovers between 12 to 18%. On these campuses, it was anywhere from 23 to 35%. As far as free and reduced lunch, on any given campus, it ranged anywhere from 90 to 98% free and reduced lunch. These were located in the inner cities in San Antonio, Dallas, Fort Worth, places like that, and then also along the border between Texas and Mexico where there was a limited English proficiency there. And one of the things we noticed is that we needed a curriculum that would engage them. And so we started a discussion of where are these children being engaged. And these children are playing with Game Boys. They are going to seeing big screen movies. They're playing with the Internet. And so there is an acute awareness of technology. And so what we did is we tapped into that. And what we did is we married up a video production company with a software company so that we have a curriculum on CD and Internet that is grades 3 to 12. That is visually engaging. It has 25,000 video links built into the text. You can actually see video footage of World War II battles and things that really make it come alive. And one of the things that we did also is we tapped into what we call edutainment, where basically we're educating students and we're entertaining them at the same time. And these children, many of them had short attention spans, and so this type of engaging curriculum grabbed their attention, and we have had amazing results with that. The other thing that we have started to do, and I'll just pose this as I wrap up, we are seeing in states like California and Arizona and other places where there is a huge move toward distance learning or independent study, as it's called in California. And basically it is where students are able to, in a even smaller environment, in a home, realize and get their curriculum online or on a CD format or whatever, and then they interact with teachers on a daily, weekly, or monthly, whatever basis that the state law dictates. And we are realizing a great number of this happening in several states, and a great many students are involved in this type of education. With the smaller school districts, and this is the challenge that the state of Texas has, the school district that I was mentioning that we set up was larger than 500 school districts in the state of Texas. You have a lot of rural, a lot of populations that are spread out all over Texas. Texas is a very large place. And trying to bus these children back and forth to school was a really challenging thing. And one of the things that we're seeing in Texas, and I'll just throw this out for your thoughts and for your to consider, a lot of smaller districts are doing what we call chartering themselves. And that provision is available in the state law here in the state of Oregon, whereas a small school district can become chartered. And by being chartered, they're able to bypass many of the, or at least some of the regulations and things that are costly to a small school district. The second thing is by doing a distance learning or an independent study program, there are students in the area that may not be participating in the local school district. Maybe they're privately homeschooled or involved in a private school or whatever else that would welcome the opportunity to be involved in a distance learning or an independent study format. And then the third thing that I would propose is that many small districts are finding that by using a technologically driven educational system, that they can, by putting the education in the hands of these students, basically, and giving them the responsibility for their learning, they can see that it shrinks down a lot of the bureaucratic overhead and things that are necessary in some of the larger educational settings. So those are the things that we've discovered and found, and I thank you for the opportunity to share, Mr. Chairman, and excited to be with you.
Thank you very much. Sorry that our committee kind of evaporated on us, but I think that we're getting this videotaped, and it should be available for anybody who's interested. I have a few questions. Senator Farioli, did you have any questions?
No, I think the presentation is excellent.
I'm wondering what the impact in Texas. They've had a longer experience with charters than we have, some 200 plus schools now.
That's correct.
What has the impact been on the finances of for education in Texas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The initial concern from the larger or from school districts was that if you set up charters, you're going to be diverting funds from the school district. But what we have discovered in Texas is that, and by no means does that mean that this is something that every state would experience, but in Texas we've noticed that the greater majority of the charter schools that have been developed were focused on students that were dropping out. And so it's my understanding here in the state of Oregon, for example, that the dropout rate is 20-25%, somewhere in that range. It depends on who you ask or what you read, but and there's always a game with numbers and you know how that is. But you know, if you were able to recover a measurable percentage of those 25% that are dropping out, that is a substantial stream of revenue. And so what we discovered in Texas is that many of the charter schools catered to this type of student. And so in reality, the financial impact on the district was actually minimal, especially in relation to where the administrators initially anticipated. The other thing that we noticed is that it really affected private education far more than it did public education, because many parents were paying for private education in addition to paying taxes, which provide for the public education system. And so the idea of having a small school in their neighborhood that had a small student-to-teacher ratio, that had some of those homegrown values that the ranchers and the farmers bring to the community, it was a very positive environment. And so many of the private schools suffered because of the charter movement, but not nearly as much. I mean, a lot more in relation than the public schools had anticipated. Does that answer your question, Mr. Chairman?
Well, that helps, you bet. That you've explained quite a bit about how you've delivered the education of these underserved students in 23 local school settings. Is that a virtual school delivered to the individual locations, and how does that work?
Well, and thank you for asking. In this particular case, it was a site-based where the content was loaded onto a server that distributed to computers. What we found is that most at-risk students or students that fit the statute definitions of being at risk came from predominantly Hispanic or African-American inner-city type settings, and so many of them did not have parents at home, and so the idea of doing a distance learning or a virtual education for them was not a practical thing, because they needed the engagement, they needed the daily oversight. But what we found is that by bringing them together in a site-based, you could craft the disciplines and the character and the system that you wanted to develop in these students. And then, but for the rural schools, we were able to do, and we are doing, this virtual education where they, in remote areas, where students can get the content, get the education, and yet are not being bused an hour and a half. In some cases out in West Texas, students are on bus for 2 hours one way to get to school because of the fact there's such a great distance there. And so this gives them, the small school district, the ability to educate those children.
Since Texas has had the charter school experience since 95. Oregon, much shorter history. What would you project, or would you make a projection about what charter schools in Oregon might look like in another 5 years?
Based on my experience is limited to Texas, and so that by and large it's not going to be as extensive as say others on a national scale. But one of the things that anytime you do a reform type movement, you tend to attract in the first phase people that may have a lot of zeal but a limited amount of knowledge. At least that was our experience. People that wanted to get involved and do something thing and are passionate about it and they believe in it, you know, and everything, but they may not have the full range of knowledge that they need. And thankfully, under the charter laws, laws that are established in Texas, there was a good system whereby a charter holder could reach out to an education service center or other people, and they could provide that knowledge base and that relationship to help them make a quality program. What we're finding in the maturing of charters in Texas is that they're getting better. I mean, they really are. Over time, as they zero in and they focus in on their core mission of what they chartered or were chartered to do, they're able to reach out to these students that were at risk and were dropping out, and they're making a definite impact. And, you know, you never know the, you know, you really can't put hard dollars to it, but down the road, the fact of recovering those students that were dropping out and were at risk of dropping out of school is going to make a tremendous financial impact. It's going to make a tremendous impact on the culture in a positive way. Does that answer your question, Mr. Chairman?
That pretty well answers the question. You have been looking at the possibility of providing some education services in Oregon. Can you share with us what that might be, or is that something that's just under development?
No, that's fine, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that we're passionate about is, because of this experience in Texas and dealing with these 3,000 students that were defined as at risk, and seeing them get excited about education and really come into the knowledge that they really could learn, that they weren't dumb, they weren't, you know, they really could succeed, and seeing the light go on. Is one of the challenges that we're passionate about is going into inner cities, and one of the things we'd like to do is possibly look at partnering with some people here in Oregon to reach out in the inner cities, in the African American communities, Hispanic communities, or other ethnic communities where they are least served or underserved, and partnering with them to reach those students and using a new and different educational model like we've just proposed to address their concerns and really engage them in the process, and we would be excited about that. The other thing we would welcome the opportunity to do, Mr. Chairman, is to partner with small school districts here in the state of Oregon, maybe in remote areas, whereby we can set up a program where they can get education delivered via the Internet or CDs or whatever to give them the tools that they need and on a less costly basis to provide an education to those students than they would do under the typical scenario that they're facing now. So,
well, thank you very much. And useful, helpful. Any questions?
Well, thank you kindly.
Yeah.
One, although
yes.
I apologize that I missed part of your presentation. What do you feel the public schools, where are they, I guess our traditional school system, where are they not serving this at-risk, or what are some of their challenges in serving this at-risk population that they might not be, in your estimation, doing as good a job as we hope they could do?
Well, thank you for asking, Mr. Vice Chairman. I think that education goes through an evolution. It goes through processes, and people try things, and sometimes things work and sometimes they don't work. One of the things that I would challenge every school, be it a charter, public school, private school, is especially being with students that are defined as at risk, is make it as small an environment as possible. These children typically are ADD, ADHD. They have a lot of distractions going on. You have to limit those distractions. And if there are a lot of activities going on in the classroom, it's hard for these students to keep a focus. It's hard for them to keep, you know, zeroed in on the task at hand. The other thing is I would challenge many of these students are coming from homes that do not provide the things that maybe all of us in this room take for granted, the things of a supportive environment, the things of character development. And so with these dealing with these at-risk students, basically you have to go in, and it's my feeling, and teach them what it means to be a person of integrity. What does it mean to be efficient or responsible? What does it mean to be a good citizen? The things that really can make for a productive thing. And then the third thing, and lastly, is to use and engaging educational system like we proposed here, which is a computer delivery, something that has a lot of video in it, something that catches in where they are. They're playing with Game Boys and big screen TVs, and they're playing on the Internet. And so they need something that engages them where they are, and I would call it edutainment. for lack of a better term, where you educate them at the same time you're entertaining them and you draw them into it. And it gives them a sense of that school really does mean something, that school can relate to me. So I don't know if that is helpful or not, Mr. Vice Chairman.
So, may I ask?
Yes.
And I'm sorry I missed part of it also, but do you have any samples of things? Did you bring anything for us to look at? Maybe I'm missing something here.
I brought some demo disc. I could leave with each of you in a brochure basically describing our program and what we're doing. Would that be appropriate?
Well, that would be appropriate.
I'm interested in what you're talking about.
Yeah. Very good. I have some of those. Fantastic.
Yes. You could leave those with our committee administrator.
It's a pleasure to meet you, and we've emailed each other quite a bit over the last month or so relating to this meeting, so it's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you very much.
Now, Mayor,
I
appreciate this because I think that the education process is obviously evolutionary.
Yes, sir.
And we had a presentation about a woman who has been very, very successful. Of course, Maria Montessori was very successful with her innovative approach of dealing with disadvantaged children and so on. And I think there's always something to learn, you know, from the new innovation. And so I am interested in what it is that you're doing.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Very definitely. Now, I would add that we do have, at least in District 4J in Eugene, I'm not from Eugene, I'm from the sister city, a very innovative alternative school program. And I know in Springfield, where I'm from, we do have an alternative school program that is attempting to meet the needs of the kids who are dropping out. And so they have a different approach in a different location. I'm not sure what they're doing particularly, but I know there's, you know, that's a concern. How do you reach the kids who have practically no support from home?
Mm-hmm.
And that's that, you know, if you have a good mother and if you chose your parents well, you probably won't have a problem. But a lot of kids didn't choose their parents.
That's correct.
Yeah.
So we have to help them. So I am definitely interested in seeing what your program is about.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. With that, we're going to close our...
Huck and Horns.
Yeah.
He missed that.
Huck
and Horns.
He probably is ignoring you now.
No, I'm not.
Didn't Oregon beat up on Texas last
year? Well, actually, I'm a Texas...